This is Jennifer Hunt with Sheila Lamont in Devizes, Wiltshire. On the 14th of October 2014, Sheila, would you just like to introduce yourself?
I'm Sheila Lamont. I come originally from London. I joined WRVS when I was living in Poole, and I worked in Dorset and I worked in Berkshire, and then I moved up to Cumbria and I worked there for WRVS. And I finally finished as a services welfare in 2010. And I'm still a member, but actually don't do anything now.
Why did you join WRVS?
I joined WRVS in 1978 because I heard an article on the radio about domiciliary books. And I felt it would be awful not to be able to read. So I rang and got introduced to the domiciliary book organiser down in Poole. And that's how I started. From there, I then went on to have my interview to join WRVS properly and started Meals on Wheels once a week. And then shortly after that, I was invited to go on a emergency training course, which I did. And then a year later, I was invited to become an emergency services instructor. So I was doing emergency services, books on wheels, and meals on wheels. And then, again, not that long after, I was invited to become a headquarters instructor, which was one who instructed the instructors. And it sort of went on from there, and I became the county emergency services organiser.
For which county?
For Dorset. And I suppose my WRVS career has been mostly emergency services, but I also continue to do Meals on Wheels. I did finish Books on Wheels because my recipients died and I found, you know, I couldn't cope with everything. So along with doing the training for emergency services and being the coordinator for all the emergency services responses in Dorset, I also went on courses up to Easingwold and represented WRVS at different meetings, you know, emergency planning meetings and so on. So it was quite exciting, really, going on from all of these. I ended up down in one of the observer corps bunker things, you know, in a nuclear war where they'd all go down and lock themselves in. And then I went to a depot in Somerset, I think it was, which was huge and had all this emergency service equipment, all the big old Sawyer boilers as far as the eye could see. So I got around a lot with emergency services. Then I moved to Berkshire and I was a county emergency services organiser there, but I was working full time at the same time, you know, so I managed to get it all in together. And again, the same thing, going up to Easingwold and representing WRVS at different meetings. And then I became, in the last big reorganisation in 1999-2000, I became emergency services manager for the North West because I bought a house up in Cumbria. And I covered Cumbria, Lancashire, Merseyside, Greater Manchester and Cheshire, which was a hell of an area, as you can imagine, as the area emergency services organiser. And at that particular time, we were then tasked to be raising money to fund. And unfortunately, I've never been good at that. I really didn't enjoy it. I enjoyed the job, but I didn't enjoy the money bit of it. And so, as the dog had died, I applied to become a services welfare officer with WRVS. And I started that in 2001. So my WRVS commitment in the sense of emergency services, etc., etc., sort of went then because I was zipping around. First of all, I was in Suffolk. Then I went to the Falklands. Then I came back and was at Catterick. And then I finally finished up in Germany. So, yeah, it's been a good career. I've enjoyed it. And all of it has been, apart from the last bit, all of it was done when I was in full-time employment up to 1999, so I was able to work it round.
And what did you know about WRVS before you joined?
Nothing, apart from the fact that I really didn't like the lady who did the books at the hospital where I was working in Poole. She was a very, very formidable lady, and I looked at her and it had WRVS on the book thing, and I thought, oh, I'm never going to join there. I just didn't like her. But when I did, you know, look into doing domiciliary books, it was then suggested that I join WRVS, which is how I got into it. And the lady that, in fact, I didn't like, she was a lady called Mrs. Grebby. I mean, she's on long dead now. And she got an MBE or an OBE or something. She was with her husband in Singapore when the Japs invaded, and she got out on the boat, one of the last boats, with her daughter, but her husband never got out. And she ended up living in Poole. And she turned out, actually, to be quite a nice lady. Formidable, but quite nice. So that was how I actually got into it, through Books on Wheels.
And what are your earliest memories of WRVS?
That it was fun. You know, we went out and we did all sorts of odd and peculiar things because it was, you know, when in doubt, you've got nobody else, you get in touch with WRVS. I mean, we went off and did refreshments at different functions. And at the time, you see, there was none of this that they'd got to pay for it. They would pay for the supplies, but we weren't having to bill them for this and bill them for that. And consequently, we ended up in all sorts of places, you know, doing garden parties, for the fire brigade, and just around all over the place. And one of the ones we did, I'll show you a photograph of, BP, I think it's BP, have special depots around the country. There's one in Southampton, there's one up north, which cope with oil spillages. They've got all the equipment to cope with oil spillages. And they were doing a demonstration for all their companies throughout the world and their subsidiaries down in Studland Bay. And we were asked whether we would do refreshments for them on the day, because we were all out on the beach. And we got special permission from the National Trust to build a trench cooker, which was one of the old things we used to build out of bricks. And we did baked potatoes and all sorts of bits. And we were all on the beach at Studland, and it was a beautiful, beautiful day. And it was that sort of thing that you went out doing. And another one we were doing for the fire service, I forget where we were, again in Dorset, where they wanted refreshments, and we were sort of stuck on a hill whacking out soup and stuff for the fire brigade. And it was just, that was how it was. But I don't think it's like, I mean, you get called in now, I believe, on a national emergency, but you are part of the local authority team. You know, you're incorporated into the local authority, whereas we could be called in and it wouldn't be anything to do with the local authority. And we got out there and did all sorts. Yeah, it was good fun.
You started with Books on Wheels. How was that organised in Poole?
Well, they had a section of the library in Poole, which was called the Domiciliary Library. And they had a librarian who was in charge of that. And what would happen was the health visitors or the doctor or relatives could get in touch with them and suggest people, or people themselves could get in touch with them, that they would like to have books. And she would visit them and she would actually take, you know, notes of what they liked, sit there and discuss the books with them. And then there was a lady called Peggy, I can't remember her surname, lovely lady, who was the WRVS organiser in Poole for Books on Wheels. She organised the volunteers. And she would then say, oh, well, Mrs. So-and-so at such and such wants whatever. And you'd go down to the domiciliary library. You'd ring the person you were going to visit and say, well, look, I'm coming along with some books. And you'd go to the domiciliary library, and with this chart that they'd given you, you'd pick out the books you think they wanted. And then you would take them. It was a once every, some did it 3 weeks, I think I did it four, and you'd go to their home and you would give them the books, and then a month later you'd come back and change them. And what was lovely about it was the fact that I was doing the Branksome area of Poole, which is very, very, very expensive. And one of my ladies, this was the one that died, she used to wait at the kitchen window because she could see me come round in the car. And she'd wait at the kitchen window and she'd put the milk on for the coffee, and then she'd totter through to the sitting room. And by the time I'd got round, it was all ready to go with the cups and everything. So I'd pour it all out and go in and we'd sit. And it was lovely because you'd have a couple of hours there talking to them about the books and other things as well. And what was interesting was that some of them would have a very strict, you know, I will read this and I will read this and I will read that. And it was how you subtly put other books in. And the ones they did love were the big picture books, particularly the royal family or whatever, because they could put them on their laps. I mean, a lot of them were very infirm, and they could put them on their laps and sit and look at the pictures, you know. And I found it very, very, what shall I say? It was, gave me a good feeling, and it gave them a good feeling, because I felt I was doing something really that was appreciated and they liked. I don't want to say they felt grateful, because that's awful, but the fact that I felt I was providing another asset for them to enjoy. And I did enjoy doing books.
How did you deliver the books?
By car.
And did you help the people who you deliver the books to in other ways, apart from just giving them?
Well, this particular lady, yes, I did take her out a couple of times. One of the days, I'd got her a book, because we were getting through all these picture books, you know, and I bought one on fish, tropical fish. And she sat there and she started dabbing her eyes, and I said, "What's the matter?" And she said, "Oh, my husband and I kept tropical fish." And I had no idea. And Paul has got a lovely aquarium, and she'd got a wheelchair, so I actually took her to Paul Aquarium, and we all went round there. I think that was the only time I took her out, because she was quite infirm, but we certainly got off to Paul Aquarium, the pair of us. I mean, we had to drive round in the car getting there. I mean, we went an awful long way to get to Paul Aquarium and coming back. But yes, yeah. But she's the only one that I did, I must admit.
Can you tell me about the other volunteers who help with Books on Wheels?
I didn't know them. Because it's almost a very solitary, you know, you go in on the day that you're going to go in and pick your books up, and you come away and you go and see your people. And no, it's unlike Meals on Wheels, where you'd all accumulate in a kitchen to pick the meals up. Books on Wheels was a much more solitary thing. And 9 times out of 10, you didn't know who else did Books on Wheels, unless they had a gathering at some point, or you met them at some meeting or other. No, it was for me, I couldn't honestly tell you anybody else who did Books on Wheels.
And at the same time, you were doing Meals on Wheels as well.
Mm.
Can you tell me about your first day delivering Meals on Wheels?
Well, I went with someone, I think. Because I don't think I'd actually been assigned a round at that point. I can't honestly remember the first day, because I did it for, 6 years? So the first day has gone into a bit of a blur. But I do remember the funny thing about it was, once you'd done the round, you really, addresses and things just went bypassed you, because you knew where you were going. And you'd head up the road, and you knew that the house that had the fence, you know, the hedge growing all over the pavement, 9 times out of 10, that was the one you were going to. You could pick them out, you know. And if somebody said to you, "Oh, Mrs. So-and-so, what's the address?" You sort of look at them a bit blankly and have to go and get your book to tell you what the address was, because you didn't know. But I did this same round in Broadstone for 6 years, so I got to know all my recipients very well. And it was very good doing it like that, rather than swapping people round, because if there was anything wrong, you could pick up on it. Because doing it once a week, as I did, you'd notice. I mean, there were a couple of occasions, one lady who, obviously, she wasn't a well lady particularly, always in her dressing gown. Every time I went on a Monday, she was always in her dressing gown. And I went in one Monday with her meal. I mean, she was fine, you know, perfectly chatty. And I looked at her and I said, "God, you're dressed. Oh, well, I had to go to the hospital this morning." I said, "Oh." I said, "Do you know, I've never seen you dressed before." And every Monday after that, she was dressed. I mean, whether that made a difference, I don't know. And then another lady I was particularly fond of, she had a very old, smelly Yorkshire Terrier. And I went in again one day, and it was obviously desperately ill. And I said to her, "You know, have you phoned the vet?" And she said, "Well, I can't seem to get through." And I said, "Well, would you like me to phone the vet?" "Well, if you would," she said. So I phoned the vet, and the vet came round and gave him an injection, and That was it. I know you'd bring the washing in if it was raining, if they got washing out on the line. And then the doctor had come round and blithely write out a prescription and sort of toss it on the table. And so what we used to do was pick up the prescription, drop it in on the way out, pick it up on the way back, and then bring it. And then another old lady, I was always amazed because they'd end up living in these big houses which they couldn't afford. And this particular old lady, she lived on the top floor of this big house in Broadstone. I think she owned it, and there were a couple down below. And she used to have to come downstairs to get to us and got to the top. And she looked really, really poorly. And she was sort of living in this little room with a one-bar electric fire. And it was freezing in there. Anyway, we got back and said to the woman that organised us, and she rang the doctor. The next week we got in there, and this woman said, "You know, the doctor came to visit me last week." "Did he?" I said. "Yes," she said. And he said he'd looked at his files, because she was well into her 80s, looked at his files and realised he hadn't seen me for a long time, so he thought he'd better come and see me. So, you know, it was that part of Meals on Wheels that I think desperately got lost when WRBS lost the contracts, because the people that delivered the meals knew their recipients and they could look out for things like that. You never just stuck the meal down and walked out. I mean, we had one, they'd never had any cutlery, and it was filthy. You held your breath when you got in there and hoped you didn't have to breathe again until you came out. And they said to us, "Look, the home care had found all these meals stacked in a drawer, never been eaten. So we were instructed to take the lids off, put them on a tray, sit her down and stick it in front of her so, you know, she'd get the smell of it, which is fine. But we could never find any cutlery. So I used to have half a dozen knives and plastic knives and forks in my car that I'd purloined from the emergency store. And we'd go in with cutlery to her, and hopefully she'd then eat the meal. But it was that sort of personal bits and pieces that you put on things. And if you ask anybody who did Meals on Wheels for WRBS, I'm sure you'd find they'd have all sorts of stories about how they got their recipients to eat it or what they did for their recipients and so on and so forth, because that was part of the service.
Where did you collect the meals from?
We had a kitchen. Yes. There was a purpose-built kitchen. I'm trying to think, was it with a school in Poole? I know in Dorchester there was a purpose-built kitchen in the WRVS office. In Berkshire there was a purpose-built kitchen. And I'm trying to think where we got them. I think it must have been a purpose-built kitchen in Poole. And we'd all line up outside and have our hot locks, you know, the thermal duties, and put them in the car and off we'd go. And my helper, she was lovely, Nell, she always used to make cheese and onion sandwiches. And we'd sit at the top of the hill in Broadstone and eat our cheese and onion sandwiches while we cashed up the money when we'd finished. But there were purpose-built kitchens for the meals.
What sort of food were they cooking in those kitchens?
I know in some they were cooked and put into containers by the cooks, but I don't think I think all the ones that I ever did were actually coming in from a firm in like the Wiltshire Farm food things. And the meals organiser every now and then will be invited to a tasting. And when I was working in Dorchester, when I went up to county, the meals organiser say, "Oh, they're coming with some new ones. Come on, we're all going to get lunch today," and we'd all have a tasting of these things. I mean, to me, the whole place always smelt like cooked cardboard. The meals were fine underneath, but when they were cooking in the ovens, they all smelt like cooked cardboard. It's a smell you never forget, and I could pick it out for you now if I was plonked out somewhere. You know, they're cooking meals in these containers. And I never felt, well, there were enough for the people that wanted them. And then something else actually started in Berkshire, because I didn't do meals in Berkshire, but the organiser there was, I forget what it was called, meals. And it was when they first started, you could order your frozen meals, and they come in once a week. And lovely story about one of the people went to deliver to this old boy, and they queried the fact that he put 8 meals instead of 7. And he said, "Well, my daughter's coming to lunch on Sunday and it's going to be nice for me to give her something instead of her giving me a meal." you know, it gave them a certain amount of control. They had to have a little hot, what they called?
Microwave.
Microwave, yeah. And they put them in that. And then WRVS would do, which is what they do now, but I think it's a commercial operation that does it. But Meals on Wheels were doing that in some areas. But unfortunately, they lost all the contracts because it went to the cheapest option. And I gather that one of the, I mean, not that we weren't a cheap option, but there we are. And then they had vans that actually had heaters in the back of them. You know, so you had sort of one person going in, and this is where you get these awful stories of somebody going in and finding them dead in bed and about four Meals on Wheels stuck in the thing. But I don't think that was ever WRVS.
Did you deliver the meals in your own car, or did you?
Yes. Yes. We got paid petrol money, and yes. And in the school holidays, I used to take my son and he'd do the round. Nell and I used to sit in the car, stop outside the house, he'd get the meal out, the tea towel, the pudding, off he'd go down the drive. I mean, this was when he was, what, five, six, and he knew all the people who were, and they all knew him, and it was a great disappointment when he went back to school. You know, when's he going to come again? Oh, well, it'd be the Christmas holidays or whatever, because he absolutely loved it. I mean, there were, we wouldn't let him go into, you know, like this old lady who had no cutlery and it stunk to high heaven. But the vast majority of them, they absolutely loved him delivering the meals to them. I mean, whether it would be allowed now, I don't suppose it would. We'd probably be contravening some act or other. But, yeah, I mean, that was his, part of his job in the summer holidays as Meals on Wheels deliverer.
When did you stop delivering Meals on Wheels?
I stopped when... I think when I became County's Emergency Services Organiser, because I was having to go to Dorchester on a regular basis, and I think I stopped then. I can't actually remember. It possibly was, yeah, possibly when I moved from Poole, I think that I had to stop doing Meals on Wheels, because it wasn't, well, it wasn't capable. I couldn't do it because of the distances and so on and so forth. So I did meals. I'm trying to think. I think I did books for 4 years and meals for six.
Is there any aspect of Meals on Wheels that we haven't mentioned which you'd like to talk about?
Well, I think the only aspect is the fact that WRVS seems to have lost all the contracts everywhere for doing them. And I think it's desperately sad, because I think the people that did them, it wasn't just Meals on Wheels. I mean, they provided a whole social services for these. I mean, sometimes the meals person was the only person they saw every week. Or if they had deliveries 3 days a week, it was the only person they saw. And it was a very effective way of keeping an eye on people who are isolated in the community. And people did keep an eye on them, because they knew them, because they were in and out sort of every week. And, yeah, that is what I think is sad, is that that's gone.
At the same time as Books on Wheels and Meals on Wheels, you're also doing emergency services. Why did you get involved with that?
Because I liked it. I loved it, absolutely loved it. I mean, I did virtually every job there was, in a very limited fashion for WRVS at the time. I mean, I must admit, I only did the clothing store a couple of times. I mean, that was a couple of duties because of people not being there. I did a couple of duties on the tea bar at the hospital. And we used to do children's holidays from Poole, which again has stopped, which I thought, I mean, I can see why it stopped. But at the same time, I feel that it gave an opportunity for a lot of children to get out of pretty dire situations and have a different experience of life altogether. And on one that we did, because we were quite effective in Poole doing children's holidays, and one of them, I was doing the transport for these two little girls to a little village right in the north of Dorset. And I went to pick them up, and it appeared to be Poole's policy to put all the really dreadful families in one street. This was a cul-de-sac, and there was barely a window or a door that wasn't boarded up and whatever. And there were these two little souls sitting there, no adult, with a case waiting for me to pick them up. And I got them in the car, and the older one, chat, 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 chat. The little one never said a word all the way there. And we got to this lovely little village in Dorset, and it was one where the side of the cottage was on the road, and it was a thatch cottage. You know, typical hardy type village. And the lady was outside because she was expecting us. And she said, oh, I don't know whether it's going to be all right. And I said, well, what's the matter? And she said, well, the carpet man was supposed to be coming to put a carpet down in their room, but he hasn't been. So I've had to put rugs down. And I said, well, I'm sure that isn't going to be a problem. Anyway, we got the kids out of the car and got their case out. And she took them upstairs into the little dormer windows of this absolutely beautiful room, you know, under the thatch, with two little beds made up with matching duvets, curtains matching, rag rugs on the floor. And, you know, their eyes were like sticking out on stalks. Anyway, I left them there and I went back a week later to pick them up. And they were two different children altogether. They'd had a fabulous time because a friend of the woman that owned the cottage, her husband had gone away, and they had a farm locally in a horse, and she'd been tasked to look after the horse while they were away. They also had a swimming pool, and she said, you know, use the pool. So the kids had gone swimming. The WI had put on one of their events that week, because there were quite a few children in the village, and they had a special children's section, and I don't know whether it was rigged or not, but one of them won the shortbread competition and the other one won the funny vegetable competition, which they duly showed me. And they must have had an absolutely fantastic time. Put them in the car and they bawled their eyes out all the way back to Poole, because all the kids in the village came out, went bye, you know, as they went off. And the woman that had them was in tears. And I took them back to Poole to this really, really run down estate. And I thought about it and I thought, well, you know, are we making these children... are we actually doing any good by this? And someone said to me, well, you've got to think about it, that quite often these children never go further than the end of the road or just to school and back. But what you've given them is memories that they'd never have had otherwise, of something completely different, something they can aspire to. And then the other one I got involved in, again in Dorset, was when they're sending 12 children recommended by the NSPCC and the social services again, six from Hampshire, six from Dorset, to a holiday camp on the Isle of Wight. And I've got the report in there of it. And I went, a lady called Paddy, who was from Dorset, and Wynne, I think she was from Dorset as well, Wynne. And we got all these kids over to this holiday camp, and we were in chalets for a week. And I never believed that I could go for a whole week with hardly any sleep. And it was... we got there, and the ladies from the Isle of Wight who'd inspected it hadn't obviously taken on board what we were coming over with. So we were in chalets with double beds. So what we had to do, the people there gave us blankets rolled up, so we had sort of two boys in one bed, because we had to do it like that. We couldn't do it any other way. And of the 12, they were between 9 and 12. One of the 12-year-olds was an absolute pain, a female, and we sent her. We had to send her back. And at the same time, the Isle of Wight WRVS were going to take them off our hands every now and then. You know, the three of us take them. But they had a big fire at one end of the Isle of Wight that year. So all the emergency teams who were going to do this were out at the fire. So we were stuck with the kids. And the holiday camp staff were brilliant, absolutely brilliant. I mean, if you want to take the report and photocopy and give it back to Jeannie. And it was just wonderful. We wrote a diary up every night. Paddy and I sat there and wrote this diary up every night. And these children, I mean, when you talk to them, I mean, we didn't ask them what it was like at home, but bits would come out, you know. And one boy, Philip, because they're all be in their 20s now, and one boy, Philip, I was particularly fond of, and he was the child of a first marriage. Mum had remarried, and there were a couple of little ones, and they're very withdrawn when he got there, very, very withdrawn. And we said that we had envelopes for all of them, and we'd said about, we worked out, I forget how much we decided, because we'd worked it out with the WRVS people, that all of them would have exactly the same amount of money to spend. So we took in what their money was and then made it up. And he wasn't going to hand his money in at all, but he did in the end. And each of the 12, they were allocated to one adult. and they were the ones that looked after their money for them. Anyway, Philip went with some very, very withdrawn. And over the course of the week, we had one day, came up to me one day and said, "Sheila, if we have a day when it's really rainy," he said, "and we can't get out, would you like me to write down some games that we can play indoors?" I said, "Yeah, it'd be great." And then they had a competition, a sort of, for the kids there, all the kids. And he got into the final of this competition, Philip did. And I really felt sorry for the other lad because he only had his mum and dad there. And when Philip was doing his, there was 11 kids, well, no, 10 kids, and three adults all cheering like mad for him. It must have been quite off-putting for the other lad. And all the staff, because the staff were just wonderful, absolutely wonderful. We had one little girl who was shoplifting and various other bits. And when we first got there, of course, it was a big dining area. You went in and they just piled food. And their table manners were appalling, absolutely appalling. And we three said, "Right, okay, we're not sitting with that. We can't be doing with that." But we sat where we could see them and we said, you know, unless the world is going to collapse, you do not interrupt us during the meal. But what we discovered after a couple of meals, they were sitting there and they were looking at other people around them. And their table manners improved over the course of the week. Instead of grabbing everything that was there, they started to be proper about it. And then they used to bring bread back for the three-legged hedgehog that used to come along at night outside. And the ducks. And I can remember we were going to, was it Black Gang Chine? And I got them in the car and it got foggy and I couldn't figure out how to turn the lights on this car because it was daylight most of the time. So and we pulled off the roundabout and Paddy's sitting there with the book and says, says, and this little voice from the back says, "Sheila, you do know how to drive this car, don't you?" Yeah. And when we got into Black Gang Chine, we got inside and said, "Right, you lot, off you go. Don't want to see you again." And off they went and had a fabulous time. So I really, really did enjoy that. It was great fun. That was really great fun. But that, as I say, was a one-off with children's holidays. What else did we do? Emergencies, hospital I did, clothing I did a bit of. I think virtually everything I've had a go at some point or other, all very minimally, but my main thrust has been emergency services.
What sort of training did you receive for emergency services?
Well, we started off, first of all, I don't think I put my training card in. I've still got it. Once a week for 3 weeks, 4 weeks, you had a programme that you did. And once a week for 3 or 4 weeks. And then at the end of that, your card was filled in that you were a trained emergency service person. To do the instructors, I had to go to Southampton. And you were trained by headquarters instructors in Southampton to become an instructor. And then that was, it was really strange because I didn't quite get the hang of it. You know, I couldn't sort of see where it was coming from. And I was coming back along the M27, I think, one day. And it suddenly dawned on me that as a headquarters instructor, training instructors, you had to look at things like the venue. What was it like? Were you going to be able to get in? Were you doing it in somebody's sitting room? And you were going to have to take a blanket to put all your emergency equipment on. Was there access to this? And it was all those sort of things that you know, were you going to have to take 50p to put in the meter so you had some lights in the church hall? And it was all that sort of thing that you had to look at as a headquarters instructor. And I think at one point I was the youngest headquarters instructor that they had. Didn't last long, but I was. And what you then did, you were invited to go and examine other emergency services instructors. So it was a level up from that. And we also added on to the courses leadership, and other bits were added on. And I got to the end of my, I wish I'd brought my training card down. I got to the end of my training card and I looked up at my who was my county organiser. I said, well, I've filled this in now. Shall I go off and do something else? But it was, yes, it was good. And it was, you felt you were achieving something with it. And at the end of the day, you came out feeling quite as if you'd done something. Yeah.
Where did you go for training?
Well, say, I think on both occasions, because the area was, what were we? We weren't southwest, we were south. And I went, our office was in Southampton. So I went to Southampton, I think, for both lots of... No, I lie. For the instructors, I did it in Dorchester because we had Sally Roper, who was from Bridport, who was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And Peggy Matthews, who was equally lovely, and she came from Poole. So the instructors we did in... the ordinary instructors we did in Dorchester, but the headquarters instructors, which I did about a year later, I had to go to Southampton. At the time, I should add, I was actually running a guest house in Poole, so my time, you know, providing I organised myself, I had the time to do it.
As well as being a headquarters instructor, did you have any other roles in emergency services?
Yeah, county organiser. So that if any emergency came in, I was the one that had to get everybody organised and out. Also, if they had any meetings between the fire service, police service, county, all of those I had to attend because I was very much included in the emergency plan for the county.
Which county was that?
That was Dorset, but also Berkshire, when I was in Berkshire as well.
And did you find the role in the two different counties very different?
Not really, no. No, because at the time, the local authority, they were the ones that organised it all, you know, the county authority. I mean, they were all singing from the same hymn sheet anyway, so you would go to one and it would be... I mean, the personalities would be different, but no, because they had a set plan that they'd been given, and they were all working to a set plan, that, you know, you just slotted in with that.
What sort of equipment were you using?
Well, it was a lot of it was ex-wartime equipment. I mean, we had these insulated containers, which were aluminium lined with cork. Some places had Sawyer boilers, as from Sawyer from the Napoleonic Wars, I think it was. They were enormous fun to get going. And when I first started training, we would be building trench cookers with bricks. And you'd build three tiers of bricks and you'd put a grill in between the first and second one. And then light your fire underneath and you cook up whatever and get the Sawyer boiler going if you'd got one. I mean, you couldn't cook in the Sawyer boiler because, to be perfectly honest, it would be most unhygienic, but you could boil water in it. And that was great fun. And one of the exercises we went on in Berkshire, we had the Sawyer boiler going, but we had tins of steam pudding in it. And there they all were bobbing around in this Sawyer boiler cooking. And, I mean, I don't think health and safety would be happy about what you were doing with food then. But, I mean, nobody ever got food poisoning from anything we cooked. And then the one up from the single trench cooker was the cross trench cooker, which was really quite something to build. And then we also built a hot plate cooker one year just for the fun of it. And if you look at some of the very early pictures of WRVS, you've got these ladies with the all the bricks and a plate on it. And then the chimney at the end and the fire, cook pancakes. We actually built one of those at one point and had all the emergency planning team from Dorchester. And we were cooking pancakes and all sorts. But, I mean, we didn't have to do that. And in all fairness, if we did go out on an emergency exercise or an emergency, it was very unlikely that we would be actually building these cookers. We did on the beach at Studland, for the Shell people, but it would be very unlikely we'd be doing it for real. You know, the stuff would be shipped in probably from somewhere. And at the Windsor Castle fire, what happened there, they brought down the fire brigade canteen, mobile canteen, which we were manning. And then on the day the fire broke out, I was going to work over at Runnymede, which of course meant I was passing by Windsor. So they'd been in touch with me and they said, well, look, if you call in, we can give you 400 and something or other frozen meals No, not frozen meals. What are they called? The ones where you pull the lever on them and they heat up. They've got a special name, the cans. I can't remember what they were, but the fire brigade had a stock of those. So they shoved all the boxes in with those, and then I delivered them at Windsor Castle for the fire service there. So it is very unlikely. I mean, in a case of direst emergency, when everything else breaks down, yes, I would still have the ability, given some bricks, I could cook you a meal.
How did you train volunteers for emergency services?
Well, you had them in the same as I did for... you had a set syllabus, and you had them in for 4 weeks, I think it was, and you did cover the syllabus. And then the last one, the fourth week, you actually did an exercise where you'd done... Because I had to do map reading, you had a... You know, you've got to get from so-and-so to so-and-so, how are you going to get there? And then they would do the bricks, make the cooker, get the soya boiler going if you'd got one, and actually do all the things that you taught them in the 3 weeks.
Did you do any exercises?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I mean, we used to try fairly regularly to have some sort of exercise where they could get out. I mean, one of the ones was down in Poole. We used to have a sort of summer get-together of everybody, all the members, and the emergency service team would actually take over doing the refreshments in the garden. So it was a type of exercise then. But mostly it was, you know, people wanted someone to prepare the refreshments for them. And we did several of those where we'd go in, do all the sandwiches, do all the drinks, serve it all up. But it was always normally in a kitchen or something of that type. You know, we weren't out there cooking out in the wilds.
How did you feel about being involved with emergency services?
Loved it. Absolutely loved it. It was like being on the sharp pointy end.
Why would you say it was like being on the sharp pointy
end? Well, it was on the sharp pointy end. I mean, when you think sort of Windsor Castle, we were there in the castle serving refreshments to the firefighters, and down the road was the fire, or down the... Because we were on the North Terrace, we could see the fire. I mean, BDH, when that blew up, I was in the middle of the Arts Centre when supposedly we had 2,000 people in there organising them, how you would organise them for it to run smoothly, like having... I mean, this was part of the training, having a quiet area... And looking after the animals and all of this. I've got something else too you might want to take and copy. Knowing what to do with them all. Making sure that it ran smoothly.
And also while you were doing all this work with emergency services, you had a meeting with Sir Philip Woodfield.
Yes. He did a tour of the country, I believe. And this was the forerunner of when I think they started to look seriously at all the premises that WRVS had and the fact that it was so fragmented. And I think Jerry Burton said there was, 600 separate bank accounts. And it was really trying to bring it all together because we were so diversified in everything that we did. And it needed to all be brought under one umbrella as such. And Sir Philip Woodfield, I think that was what he was tasked with. So he came to Poole and me and the meals lady and the hospital lady and so on and so forth. So sat and he just asked us questions, about what had gone on and how it had gone on. But it was, I think that was the attraction of it, was it so eccentric. I think that's the only word you can describe it as. I mean, it was just a one-off because it had just all fragmented out from what it had been. I mean, where it is now, I have no idea, but I don't know whether you've seen Lady Reading's tapestry.
I've seen pictures of it.
Yeah, it was at Milton Hill. And it was absolutely wonderful, but there's 20 functions on there that WRVS did or WVS did. And when the wartime ones dropped off, they just found other things to do. You know, it couldn't go on as it was. I mean, it was very much a grassroots thing. You know, you saw a need, what can you do? And you went off and did it. And I think that was what Sir Philip Woodfield was. I don't think they had any idea. I mean, the government were giving out this money, but as far as they could see, they were getting nothing back for it. And I think that's where he came in, to just try and see what was going on out there, because I don't think anybody had any idea.
And what sort of changes was Jerry Burton making at that time?
Well, Jerry was tasked with getting all the money that on a certain date. He had to be able to, if the accountants came along and said, "Look, what have you got?" He had to be able to tell them exactly how much money WRVS had got. A lot of this, I think, was brought in. The Charities Act was tightened up very much in the mid-90s, and it was after, you're probably too young to remember, there were several cases. I know one was a cancer charity where they'd gone off with this, and there was seemed to be no regulation at all, and people were being, you know, found to be stealing from these charities, and nobody knew how much the charities had got. I mean, we had, in Poole, we had different, well, goodness knows how many different charities. I mean, another one, not charities, bank accounts. I mean, another one was that somebody left us £300 in Poole for the people of Poole. And this was another one I was sort of vaguely involved in. And we decided to buy a caravan out at Milton Hill. There was a lovely caravan site at Milton Hill in Hampshire. And we bought it and we kitted this whole thing out. And the idea was that over the season, families who would not be able to afford a holiday could go and stay there. So it was the same price right the way through the year. There was none of this banging it up at, you know, the kids' holidays and so on. And again, people were recommended by social services. I think it was mostly social services. And they could come in and they had a card and they could pay 50p a week or whatever they wanted. I think we were charging something like £30 for a week. And they could come in and actually pay as they went along. We could arrange transport for them to get from Poole to the caravan site. Once they were there, they were on their own, and we could arrange transport for them to come back. We had an arrangement with Highcliffe WRVS that they would go in and clean it for us on a Saturday. And these people go and have an absolutely fabulous, it was a beautiful site. And, you know, I think of all the people, I mean, it ran for about 3 or 4 years, I believe, and of all the people that went, I think there were only one or two couples that we turned around and said, no, we wouldn't have them again. And it was the most fulfilling thing, but again, the money went into a different account. And you had one with the Portman for this and one with somebody for that. And this was, you know, you set up something or other, like a lunch club, would pay their money into one, they'd open their own account up. And this was what Jerry was confronted with, was all these accounts and absolutely no idea of how much money WRVS had. So that was his biggest task when he joined, to get it all together under one, so that on the 31st of March 19, whatever it was, he could say, right, WRVS has got X million pounds. He was a nice bloke, Jerry, I liked him.
How did you feel about the changes he made?
That I could... I realised all along that there needed to be changes made. That, for one, I could see the point of that. Two, I could see the point of shutting down all these little offices everywhere, because they were serving no purpose at all. I mean, we were having to provide lighting and heating, and it would maybe open once a week, twice a week. You know, they'd grown up and they were sort of peppercorn rent from the local council or whatever. But we, to me, it needed to be centralised. I mean, I could understand in a small town centralising it all to one office. That I could agree with. And I would, you know, anybody that said anything, I said, well, yes. But then I think they went too far. They lost a lot of people because they didn't have a central point for people to go to. And that was a shame, I think. And they did lose people then. And they rationalised too far as I was concerned. I could see why they were doing it. But the other thing that I felt, well, pardon me, that they had, again, I would explain to people, and I thought that a lot of people, the actual leaders of these different groups, didn't go about it in the right way, was when all the various regulations, the health and safety regulations came in, and people were having to have That was the one. When they had to have chiller cabinets in the hospital. And ladies had been going in there for years, whacking out sandwiches, you know, buttering sandwiches and so on and so forth and whatever. And, oh, I've never poisoned anybody and I'm this and I'm that. And I think a lot of these changes gave the opportunity for people who perhaps did want to get out, to get out. But then you've got things like where one of the organisers went in one day to one of the hospitals where they got this chiller cabinet. And there were a pile of sandwiches outside the chiller. And what are they for? Well, people don't like cold sandwiches. You know, which was totally defeating the object of the thing. But if you sat there and explained to them that the sandwiches were made up at a central point, they were put into container and brought to you, and you could prove that those sandwiches had been put into the optimum temperature again, then if anything happened, it wasn't down to you because you'd done exactly what you should have done. So if there was a problem, they could trace it back and they'd look at you and say, oh. But then we did have fun with the sticky buns, because I was working for a time as a locum cardiac technician at Boscombe Hospital, which has now been pulled down. And they had a lovely WRVS tea bar in the middle of outpatients. And they used to have these lovely sticky buns. And our morning treat was a cup of coffee and a sticky bun. And one day I went along to get them and I looked at the woman and I said, they're not very sticky, are they? She said, what do you mean? I said, well, they used to be stickier than that. I said, if you're going to have a sticky bunny, you've got to have a lot of sticky on the top. Oh, right, she said. Well, she didn't know that I knew the organiser for Bournemouth, and she had a word with the organiser. The following day, these women are standing there with these dripping sticky buns. Sticky all over. That was one of my triumphs, actually, and got the sticky buns back. But, I mean, I went along with all the changes, absolutely all the changes, because I could see why they were needed. I mean, I could see why the government were turning around and saying we'd have to start funding ourselves. But I have completely lost the plot where we have to keep having all these reorganisations, which really don't seem to achieve anything. I mean, at one time they brought in fundraisers. And I was at a much more local level. And I was actually at a thing that we were doing refreshments at in the emergency services. And there were these two women with a stall and these beanies, you know, these beanie baby things. And they were the fundraisers. Well, if they sold one beanie, they were lucky. I could not see. And they were getting a car, they were getting a computer, obviously getting a salary. But how many of them actually justified being a fundraiser was completely beyond me. But then they disappeared. And the other thing that I did get quite hurt about was when I went to the meeting in, was it 2000? Was it 2000? Where we had the, what's the big hotel? The Scandinavian hotel. Similar to the Hilton. They'd opened one up at Manchester Airport, and this was when we were at Milton Hill, and the secretary had managed to do a deal with them for all the managers all over the country to go to this airport, to the hotel, as a dress rehearsal before they actually opened, if you can understand me. They wanted to see that everything worked and everything was so on and so forth. And off we all went. And it was when, I could never say her name,
Tina Tejan.
Yes. Took over as chairman. And she got up on the stage and she had a fork, a garden fork. And she's sort of pretending to, and this is the way forward. We must do this and this and this and this. And, you know, forget the past and all the rest of it. And I thought, no, I can't go with that. You know, we've got a wonderful past. It's a past we should be proud of. We should not be literally chucking the bathwater out with the baby. Because that's what she was saying we should do. And, of course, a lot of the people there were new managers who'd not been in WRVS before, had no conception of the history of WRVS or the ethos of WRVS. And, of course, they're all thinking this is wonderful. And again, a lot of them were people who'd never managed volunteers before. And this was another thing that, of course, caused awful problems. Because you manage volunteers differently to how you manage staff. And it was the tradition that went. Maybe I'm a dinosaur. I think I probably am. But it was the fact that they were getting rid of this great chunk of what I felt was a wonderful, colourful tapestry of what WRVS and WVS had been. And you were just chucking it away. Hmm. Did I answer that one?
Yes. What did you think about the changes in 1997 when we sort of started to focus on emergency services, old people's welfare and hospitals?
I think that is going back to what I said originally. Because we were so diverse, everything had to be brought under a much more manageable structure. I mean, the only one that's really diverse now, you've got emergency services, hospitals, meals, food. It's all fairly straightforward. But the community service is really the only one that is more diverse now, where you've got lots of, well, you did have lots of little bits that came under the umbrella of community services. And it's that one that, in some ways, we're working at odds with other organisations, like Age UK, like Red Cross. I think St John's have more or less opted out of everything like that now. I don't know that they necessarily do, but Red Cross do a lot of community stuff. And we're all fishing in the same pool, basically, offering the same things. I mean, for example, they were saying we've taken the women's off because we want to attract more men. But I know from Age UK's concern, they're desperately trying to look at things that will attract men. I mean, they've got men in sheds for one of them. And I think that's about it, actually. I don't know what other things you get with men in. Not an awful lot. And then there's a report this week that's saying that there's going to be a 60% increase in the number of single men that are lonely. You know, elderly between here and 2030 or something. I mean, it's very difficult to get men to join anything, actually. You know, the only time I see men as a group, men in sheds, yes, that's working. I don't know whether you've got men in sheds down here, have you?
No, I don't think so.
Might be a Northwest thing. And what they've done is, well, in Cumbria anyway, there's a shop they've taken over in Cockermouth where people can take furniture that they don't want anymore. And these guys are in there with their screwdrivers and their sanders and all the rest of it. And they're doing up this furniture and then selling it. And that seems to be quite a popular thing to do. But other than that, and I think there is a men's club in one of the villages near me, but that is about it. It's very difficult to get men involved in anything. And I also go to the nature reserve where they buried all the cattle. And they've got volunteers up there. And you do get a lot of men there doing that, you know, out volunteering, sticking in stakes and whatever. But I don't know what it is that men have got about joining things. You know, they just don't seem to think it's them. And it's trying to find something that you can, a hook that you can get them onto.
When did you become employed by WRVS?
Well, I always had a grant. Once I became county organiser, which we weren't allowed to talk about, you signed the Official Secrets Act and you had a grant. I mean, it wasn't much, but it was something. I mean, this was another thing. Ah, yes, that was another thing I was going to say to you when it came out about all this reorganisation and management structures. And, well, Mrs. Smith, she was in there 5 days a week as the organiser doing this, that and the other. And I pointed out to them that Mrs. Smith probably had a grant, but she wasn't allowed to talk about it because you couldn't expect the secretarial staff and so on to give that commitment and not give them some money. And they all went, oh, yeah, I think Mrs. Smith went down in their estimation because they thought she was very noble going in 5 days a week. But then I became full-time employed when I started services welfare. Oh, no, when I became area organiser for the Northwest, which was 2000. Yeah, 2000.
And what did that role involve?
Well, that was being emergency services manager for the whole of the Northwest, and that was making sure that we had the teams, liaising with the local authorities, organising, you know, finding that we had people to do the various bits and pieces that we were asked to do around the whole area.
Did you go on emergencies for the North West?
Most of them, yes. I was there when the M6 was shut up and we opened the sand centre as a rest centre for the lorry drivers. So that was good fun. We were bedding them down upstairs. And because all the hotels were full, we couldn't get anybody in those. And people were coming off, being decanted off the trains and things. So the sand centre is a... Do you know the sand centre? Because you're up there, aren't you? Somewhere. Mm. You know, sort of it's a recreational facility. And we had them in there for the night. What else did I get involved in? Because I'd gone by the time the floods happened in Cockermouth. No, I don't think we had that many emergencies. Not real emergencies while I was up there. It was mostly community emergency involvement.
How long were you an emergency services
manager up there? It was 20 months, I think. I hated it. No, I lie. I loved the work part of it, but I hated having to go asking for money. It's just not me. That was the bit I really disliked. And that was why, as I say, I moved over to services welfare.
And when did you move over to services welfare?
2001.
Where did you first go?
When I started, I was at Bassingbourne to do my training. And I was there for... I think I joined in the September, and then I was posted in the December, I believe. I was there for a very short time, because what happened was, it was, because I'd worked for 10 years in residential care, and I was there when community care came in, and all the Residential Care Act and the, you know, the dignity and all the fulfilment, writing up the reports, the correct way to write reports. And I actually had my residential, senior management residential care certificate. I'd done that on a day release thing. My argument was, and still is, that care is care, regardless in which situation you put it. So when I got to Bassingbourne, of course, I had all that care part there, like what you could say, what you couldn't say, what you wrote in reports, and so on and so forth. So really, it was the military side of it I had to learn, the military structure. And so I was moved on fairly quickly from there to Wattisham, which is where Prince Judy is, or was, with 3 Army Air Corps. And Harry, he's there. And I was at Wattisham for 2 years. Because I'd said when I had my interview, you know, they were saying about, you do realise you'll have to go where you're supposed to go. Yeah, yeah, that's no problem. I said, but could I state quite categorically now that I really do not want to go to Cyprus? And they looked at me, well, everybody. And I said, yeah, they might. I said, but I've been to Cyprus on holiday. I said, it's too hot. I said, I couldn't cope with it. I'm sorry, you know, fine for a holiday, but to actually live there, I really don't want to know. And if you've got loads of people who want to go to Cyprus, I mean, put them way ahead of me. But, I said, I want the Falkland Islands in letters 6 inches high on my file. Went off to the Falklands.
What sort of services were you providing for the troops?
Well, it was different in different places. Wattisham, we had a club with a big snooker table and a kitchen and darts and whatever. And you basically, you were there to listen to them, you know, if they had a problem, because you weren't army and they could talk to you quite confidentially about things. I mean, you had a set protocol that if they told you they were going to chuck themselves off the roof or something like that, you'd do. But really, it was to be a sounding board for them, to sit there and, if you could, offer advice. If not necessarily, you were more of an enabler, because you had this knowledge of what was out there, so you could sort of push them to, well, go and speak to so-and-so, or have you done this, or have you done that? So you were really like an auntie. I mean, they did call us aunties, and that was more what it was, that you were someone there for them to talk to, who wasn't military, and, you know, was sort of, what's the word I want, neutral. Mm-hmm. that was our main task, and also to keep an eye on, see if there was any trouble brewing or anything anywhere. But coupled with this, you ran a recreational facility. But in all fairness, in all the cases I dealt with, all the places that I went, the recreational facility was, what, 75% of the job, I should think. And, I mean, like keeping your snooker balls clean and ironing the snooker table and that type of thing. But it varied. That was Watersham. And then we had a nun on the chaplaincy staff. She was lovely. I'm still in touch with her, Rita. And she used to bring her car. And we used to go round to all the hangars where the boys were working with chupa chups, you know, the big lollies on sticks. Yeah. And we'd deliver those all round. Well, they put the knockers on that. That was another bone of contention, but that's beside the point. And we went round, and they all knew us. They knew Rita was a nun, but, you know, it was just get out there and see them, because they didn't come to the club, because Watersham were all trained soldiers, so they all had a life, a lot of them outside. I mean, they were married, and the single ones, you know, had cars and stuff like that. So it was unlikely they were going to come to the club to any great extent. I mean, lunchtime they would, because they had nowhere else to go. But in the evenings, you didn't get many people in. And that was one way of getting out, them knowing you were there.
And were you doing the same sort of work on the Falklands Islands?
Yes. We didn't do a tremendous lot of welfare as such. Oh, I don't know. I say that. We did a lot of chatting, you know, guys would come in but we had this lovely facility there. It was a really super facility. We had a lovely kitchen where they could do toast and coffee and tea and whatever. And we had a snooker table, we had a billiards table, we had a whole library of DVDs and, no, videos and books. And we had newspapers in there, and it was all armchairs and sofas and everything, and they could just come in there, and it was completely out of the whole military altogether. And it was just somewhere that they'd come over, because I mean they were all stuck over there, and especially the guys who'd been there for several, you know, on several tours. I mean, there's only so much penguin watching you can do, and when they were on about their third or fourth tour over there, you know, coming into us was, and the other thing, of course, was there was an awful lot of drink, which wasn't a particularly good idea. But I could understand how on their fourth tour they'd got a bit fed up with it all. And they'd come in and we were open all day. And, yeah, it was a good facility we had there. And we did have the odd welfare thing, but not a great deal, not a vast amount. And of course, because there were two of us, we could work it that we could get out and see things. And we had a Land Rover that Jerry had supplied at some point. The lady I was with, Angela, who I've just been up to stay with actually, she was saying, when I spoke to her on the phone, I said, I want to go over there and I want to be able to do everything I possibly can while I'm there. And she said, well, I'm glad you've said that. So what would happen was we'd cover for each other. So if it meant one of us worked 4 days or double shifts or whatever, we'd do it so the other one could go off and do whatever they wanted to do. And we both had a fabulous tour over there. Oh, where I got that. It's mascara. We had a super tour over there. I've got some photos. I'll show them. That was good.
And how did the servicemen treat you on the...
Oh, wonderfully. We were the weavers. We were called the weavers. And we got invited to all sorts of bits and pieces. You know, any do's that were going on, we were always invited. And very social. Very, very social. I mean, it had to be. And we had a Burns night one night, and we reused the dragon from the pantomime as the Loch Ness Monster and borrowed flippers from the Aqua Club. We made it the Loch, and we had flippers from the Aqua Club and went as the Loch Ness Monster for the Burns night supper. And, there was all sorts of things we got involved in while we were there, and it just was great. It really was. And I mean, celebrating Christmas. Fixmas it was. On the 25th of June we had Fixmas, because it was the middle of the summer. It was good. It was good. I had a wonderful year there. But at the end of it, in all fairness, I was ready to come home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, the charms of the Falklands. Have you ever been up to Stornoway or on the Outer Hebrides? Or
No.
It's pretty bleak. And as I say, I've done the penguins and I felt the constrictions of being on an island. You know, you could wake up in the morning and think, oh, I'll do sand, sand. But you couldn't because you couldn't get hold of whatever it was. And you sort of just, it irritated me in the end. I mean, I like to be able to get down into the town and, oh, I'll get this and I'll get this and I'll get this. And after a year, I was penguined out. I was ready to come home. But I'm so glad I did it. And, of course, the other thing, I was really lucky. My dad was in the Navy. And in the 1930s, he was down in the South Atlantic. And there was one of the Arctic expedition things, the British Antarctic Association. They'd lost some of their people. And they got in touch with Dad's ship in Stanley. And they went off to see if they could find them, which they did. They were safe. And he landed in South Georgia. And I can remember these little squidgy box brownie pictures he had, black and white, where they were flinching a whale. And I wrote to the COS, what was he? Wasn't a Lettice, Chief of Staff, and said, you know, could I be considered to go down? Because they used to take them down on the, whichever ship was on station down there, to South Georgia. Could I be considered to go down? They explained about these photographs of my dad and so on and so forth. And I got back from Chile because my son came over to stay for a fortnight. And I got back from Chile and I was sat in the mess eating my own. You're off on the Dumbarton Castle next week. So down I went to get on the Dumbarton Castle, which I hadn't realised at the time had no stabilisers. It was a warship, a frigate. And there were six of us went down on it. And it was just an amazing experience. We landed at South Georgia and I got off the boat and I'm walking along and thinking my dad was here. You know, it was incredible. And then we went on down to the South Sandwich Islands, which again I'd looked up on the internet and found out all about them. And it was just, when you were just going along, you knew you were near an island because the smell was appalling with the fish. And we had to do iceberg duty. And there were three of us and you did it on the watches, you know, the four-hour watches that the Navy do, and you'd be on the port bow, and you'd be looking out for growlers with you. And these are the little bits that break off from the bigger icebergs. Then you'd have to go on the foghorn thing and tell them in the bridge that you'd spotted. And then you'd rotate round. You'd have 20 minutes out there, depending how cold it was, then 20 minutes inside, and then 20 minutes the other side, and you... And we got down to the South Sandwich Islands and some of them managed to land on them. We didn't. It was just too dangerous for us to attempt it because of the swell. And because it was the captain's last trip on this particular ship, we went down to the Antarctic Circle. And it's completely neutral, the other side of the Antarctic Circle. So we had to sort of come alongside the imaginary Antarctic Circle. And we got pictures of us all with our hands in the Antarctic. And we came back and it was a force 9-10 gale all the way back. And I sort of, apart from going to the loo, I just didn't get out of my bunk. It was just horrible. Really was horrible. But I would not have missed it. It was just wonderful. And then for my 70th, I wanted to go and see the Northern Lights. And, of course, we crossed the Arctic Circle. So I said to the lady on the reception desk, you know, do you have a thing to say that we've crossed the Arctic Circle? And, oh, no, she said. I said, well, I explained about my Antarctic one. And I said, I've got a certificate to say I've... And I said, it'd be lovely to have one from the Arctic. So, oh, I'll get in touch with the company, she said. And blow me if they didn't issue certificates for us that we crossed the Arctic Circle. Well, I've got two, one for the Antarctic and one for the Arctic, which I'm really pleased about. But... after that, it all sort of settled down a bit. I didn't go anywhere else. But Chile was lovely. I enjoyed Chile. And it was really getting out and doing everything you could.
What happened to WRVS's role in services welfare when you finished in the Falklands?
Well, they just shut it down. They stopped sending people out there. What happened was, I mean, it was costing God knows how much for the government to keep the Falklands going. you know, the garrison there. And I think, to be quite honest with you, it was a cost-cutting exercise, because they had a library there that had videos and whatever. And they decided, first of all, that all our videos would go. I mean, they effectively started to take away the things that we were doing. And it was only a matter of time, I think, before they said, right, okay, that is it, full stop. You know, we're going to close down the whole thing in the Falklands, which is what they did. I mean, I don't know how many they went. Well, if I left in, how long they went on after I came back. But it wasn't that long. I can't remember when they actually shut it down. You probably could find out, I suspect. Yeah, so we're not there at all now. And I'm so grateful for having been there. It was just wonderful.
And while you were involved with Services Welfare, how did WRVS change during that time?
It contracted. I was aware of the contraction of WRVS. Because I'm, obviously I've still got friends that were in WRVS. Oh no, it's... The two friends I've got now, the four of them actually, none of them actually were involved in WRVS. I was a bit of a one-off in the sense that I had been WRVS for so long and then gone into Services Welfare. I was a bit of an anomaly in that sense. And I often got the impression that Services Welfare was a thing apart from WRVS, whereas I was for, you know, the crossover. Mm-hmm. And the bits that I did hear, it just seemed that they were contracting. The things they were doing were getting less. They were getting more centralised, if they were getting anywhere, but in the centralisation, they were losing the spread of WRVS, which there had been, you know, all over the counties and things like that. You know, in the village you'd have a WRVS rep, and all of that seemed to have gone, because the central point of it all, or whatever, seemed to be getting further and further away from the people that were members, if you can understand me. And as I say, when I was in Services Welfare, no, before I joined Services Welfare and was area organiser for emergency services. I mean, I had emergency service teams in Appleby, in Ulverston. All the towns all had their own emergency service team. And I worked with the WRVS Meals on Wheels organiser, and the whole of Cumbria all had their Meals on Wheels teams. You know, so all the little villages were all covered. Everything was covered. And all of that disappeared. They had a tea bar out at West Cumberland Hospital, I believe, because I went there to have a look at that. And they had a court tea bar in Carlisle. I think they might have had a contact centre in Carlisle as well. I mean, WRVS cropped up all over, but all of that's gone. Everything has gone. The only thing they've got now is the, as far as I'm aware, there are some of them that are part of an emergency team for the county. But it's down in Ulverston. I think they've got a tea bar or something down there. And that's it.
And when you returned from the Falklands, did you get involved with WRVS in any other way?
Well, when I came back, I was at Catterick. And it is a full-time job. I mean, it's actually a six-day-a-week job, Services Welfare. Mm-hmm. You start at 4 o'clock on a Sunday, and you work till 10. And then you do two shifts, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. You have Friday afternoon off, and you have Saturday as a whole day off. So you finish lunchtime Friday, and you start again at 4 o'clock on Sunday. So, and then you're working 9:30 till 1:30, and then from 5:30, 6 o'clock until 10 o'clock at night. So in the day, you get a bit off in the middle of the day, but it is quite an arduous job doing the double shift. And you find, I used to find that I occasionally did things in the afternoon, but I found if I sort of scheduled to do something every afternoon, I just got so tired, because you come in at 10 o'clock at night, you'd be wide awake, so you're sitting there waiting for yourself to sort of drop off a bit. And I mean, all the WRBS ladies will probably tell you this, that it is, you don't realise, even though you're not actually working hard as such physically, that when you stop and go on holiday and have a few days off, you're wiped out for a couple of days, because you just... And then I was over 2 years at Cataract, I think, and then, of course, I went to Germany, and again, I was on the shift pattern there. So you didn't get time to sort of do anything particularly.
And when did your employment with WRBS end?
September 2010. That was with Services Welfare. Mm-hmm. That was when I retired. I should have been on a three-month contract, or three-month posting, which would have brought me up to the January of 2011. But because I was living up in Cumbria, and I thought I cannot cope with the thought of moving back to Cumbria into an empty house in January. Mm. So because I was over the retirement age anyway, I was, 67 at the time, I got in touch with Denise and said, look, I'm going to go in September, because then I can go when the weather's fine, the days are longer, I can get back, get myself sorted out, then into the winter. So that's what I did. And that's when I ceased work.
And did you remain involved with WRBS? Or kept in touch with the organisation?
Well, yeah, I mean, I've got, not WRBS as such, but I've got Jean, who lives at Oswald Street. She retired last year, I believe. Lorraine, she lives down in Peterborough. There were six of us went from Germany, actually, on 2010. And Lorraine was another one. So, but she has taken on a club in Peterborough, which is WRVS. Because that was going to be a hub. Whether it is a hub or not, I don't know. Jean is not really doing anything with WRVS at all now. Angela, who's up in Scotland. Now, what was she doing? Well, I think she was doing the tea bar. Yeah, I don't know if it was the League of Friends or WRBS tea bar. And she was going around one day doing something, and this woman, I don't know who she was, came stalking up to her, and she was such and such and such and such, and informed her that she couldn't, even though everything was wrapped, right? And, okay, you were pouring out tea, but everything... cakes, whatever, was all wrapped. She couldn't do it with rings on, any jewellery on at all. And Angela just stood and looked at her, because she wasn't touching anything.
No.
So she more or less, and she was hospital, this woman. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, didn't you manage her for the tea bar? Oh, no, she never said anything. So she thought, well, stuff it, I can go and do something else. And that's what she did. So whether she is still officially... You see, I did find that a lot of these people were never officially members of WRBS. You know, they'd gone into Services Welfare, but they were not actually WRBS members. So they never got... When I turned up with my long service medal, you know, well, I've been doing this job for so-and-so and so-and-so. But they'd never actually joined WRBS as an organisation, you see. So, I don't know any others that crossed over. They were all employed as Services Welfare.
Is there anything that we haven't mentioned that you'd like to talk about?
I think I owe WRVS a lot, because when I joined, my marriage was going tits up, basically. And I wasn't happy at home. And I was two different people. I'd be one person at home, but I could be me with WRVS. And I think that's really why I enjoyed it so much, you know, because they saw things in me that they could develop. Mm-hmm. And it was a saving grace, to be quite honest with you. I could go out there and I could be the flamboyant, bossy, wasit character that I am. Whereas at home, I was totally different. And then when I did get divorced, they were a support. You know, the ladies that knew what my situation was, they were there. Not that I ever leaned on them to any great extent, but they knew, you know, it's always been a very great support to me. And I have a great deal of fondness for WRVS because it got me over a very difficult time in my life. And I just I try not to think about it now, but the WRVS that I knew really has gone. And that I find is quite sad. Yeah, finish now.
And what has been the biggest change to WRVS that you've experienced?
I think that they've lost their way. Before, they had a direct purpose, however they went about doing it. But now they seem to be sort of floundering about what, you know, how they're going to do it, what they're going to do. I mean, they sort of clutch hold at one thing and we'll do that and then another. And they seem to have got rid of, I suppose, because of legislation, I suspect, is one of the things. You see, they had these contact centres, which I thought were brilliant, but I don't think we do that anymore. I think there are contact centres, but we're not involved. You know, where the parents, they can't, the children are brought along to see whatever. I mean, children's holidays, again. I mean, I think what they did was absolutely brilliant. But again, you can't, I mean, the lady went in, the children's holiday organiser went in and interviewed the people that were going to have them. That was all it was. Oh yeah, they seem nice enough. Okay, we'll do so and so. And then this child was parked with them. But there was no, you know, what's the word? The criminal records or anything like that. I mean, okay, one or two possibly fell apart. But the vast majority that I knew of, the kids enormously benefited from it. And I like to think that it gave them a look at something else that they'd never have seen under any other circumstances. I mean, there was one little boy who went to Wimborne to stay with a teacher, single woman, and in the summer holidays. And she took him to, and they brought all these cardboard boxes back from the supermarket. And they built a fort and they built something else and something else. And he wanted to take them all back with him. And there was this car that came to collect him, filled up with all these cardboard things. And there was another one where they'd caught a frog in a jam jar. And I spoke to the driver and she was saying, they kept opening the jam jar. I was terrified this blooming frog was going to leap out over the top of me. And then Barbara had a little girl, again from a really crappy estate, who spent her time at the front window looking out. And she's saying to Barbara, you don't have many police cars around here, do you? And then Barbara said to her one day, okay, we're having eggs for tea. How do you want them done? So she said, what do you mean? Well, how do you want them cooked? There's only one way to cook an egg. You smash it over a pan. That was it. She'd never had a boiled egg or a scrambled egg or a poached egg or anything. And it's nice to think that they've found this. And this Philip, as I was telling you, who got really quite chatty, when they went back, of course, there was the Hampshire bus and the Dorset bus. And I got on the Hampshire bus to say goodbye to all the kids. And they were all, bye, bye, bye. And there was Philip sat by the window. Bye, Philip. Couldn't get a word out of him. And I thought, what are you going back to? You know? And yet he'd had an absolutely fabulous week. He really had. And, you know, you look at them and you think, oh, poor little souls. I mean, they're all sharing clothes. And the lost property, the ladies in Lost, you know, the chalets, were picking out things for them. So they ended up with all sorts of bits and pieces that were in lost property. And it was just amazing. Absolutely amazing. I'll let you have the report of that. It's a bit horribly carbonised, but so you can read it.
And what do you think is the future for Royal Voluntary Service?
I like to think it will carry on, but I think unless something drastic can be done, I think the funding is going to be very, very difficult. And I think as a result of funding, it will contract even further. Because what funding there is for local authorities to provide services, unless WRVS can come up with a magic solution that the local authorities are going to, oh yeah, that's what we'll do, I think it's just going to get, I'd love to be wrong. I really would love to be wrong, but I think it's going to wither and die.
And what has been your most memorable moment as a volunteer?
I haven't really had time to think about this one, but I think one of the ones that will stick, I mean, I've got lots of pictures in my head of things that have happened, but I think one of the most wonderful ones, and it always makes me laugh, was when I was at the Windsor Castle Fire, and it was dark, and it was foggy, and it was diesel lamps and all sorts. And it was before they had the new uniforms, and a couple of firefighters, one of whom I knew, called Ron Swan, from Maidenhead, I think. Two of them came at me out of the gloom along the North Terrace, because the fire was at the far end of the North Terrace and we were this end of the North Terrace. And two of them were coming out of the gloom towards me. And Ron recognised me and came up and gave me this big hug, and they were in the old Woolham uniforms, and he was soaked, absolutely soaked. Anyway, we gave him a cup of tea and they're sort of like this. And it was at the time of the Monty Python thing. And I said to Ron, now, come on, Ron. I said, are you ready? Always look on the bright side of life. Ba-dum, 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 ba-dum. And the two of them went off back up to the fire in the mist. And all you could pick out was the fluorescent bands on their jackets and on their trousers, and you could hear always look disappearing up into the fog and the fire and everything else, and I could still close my eyes and hear them disappearing into the distance. That was lovely. I mean, I like that. I mean, I have loads of them, far too many to even contemplate. Wonderful, wonderful memories of all of it, really.
Thank you, Sheila, for talking to me today and make a really good contribution to our Voices of Volunteering project.